This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The XCOMs, written by Brett Battles, performed by Allison Johnson.
1. February 5th, Croatia. In the future, all meetings of the committee would take place virtually. On this, the day of their inaugural conclave, however, the members would be convening in person. Though there were many differences between the 7 voting committee members, they had at least one very important thing in common. Each had experienced a personal loss in which forces that could have prevented the tragedies had not lifted a finger. These scars ideologically aligned them and made them well-suited for the work the committee had been created to undertake. Like the members themselves, the gathering's location had been meticulously chosen. A place grand enough to honor what was about to take place, but one that would make it nearly impossible for anyone to eavesdrop on the committee's proceedings. Though built under a different name, the ancient fortress overlooking the Mediterranean Sea had been known as the Angel's Keep for most of its existence. The oldest parts of the castle had protected the Balkan coast since the time of the Romans. The armory room, buried deep beneath what was known as the Old Saints Tower, had only one way in and out. A circular table filled the middle of the room, 8 chairs spaced evenly around it. Behind the chairs were 8 flat-screen monitors, positioned so that no matter where someone was sitting, a screen would be visible. Placards sat at 7 of the places, but instead of displaying members' names, on each tag was written a different day of the week. At each of the 7 spots were also a glass of water, a pen, and an envelope containing a single sheet of paper. Nothing sat at the 8th place. The committee members arrived with their personal security details via prearranged SUVs that dropped off each party in a scheduled order that saw no 2 members arriving at the same time. Though the bodyguards were welcomed on the castle grounds, they were not allowed in the meeting room. A waiting area with comfortable seating, food, drinks, and entertainment was provided for them in the caretaker's lodge along the castle's north wall. Upon entering the armory, each member silently took one of the placard places and waited, some more patiently than others. This was the first time any of them learned who else would be serving on the committee, so each new arrival was scrutinized by those already in attendance. Given the lofty world the members traveled in, it was inevitable several knew each other from elsewhere. In these cases, a nod was exchanged, but no words were spoken. 2 minutes after the 7th member arrived and took her seat, the acting administrator entered the room, locked the door, and sat in the 8th chair. Unlike the others, who had all come empty-handed, he carried a leather portfolio that he laid on the table, unzipped, and opened like a book. Inside was a short stack of papers, topped by the meeting agenda. He studied the rundown for several seconds before looking at the others. "Good evening," he said. The members returned the greeting. "It is my honor to call to order the first meeting of the committee." In the weeks prior to the meeting, the acting administrator had made personal visits to each member, so there was no need to introduce himself. He glanced at the agenda again. He knew every word on it, but the pause would provide a sense of order he knew the others were expecting. When the appropriate amount of time had passed, he said, "Your transfers have all been received, so I am therefore able to certify that the committee is fully funded and ready to begin its work. The first item of business is member designations. With the exception of critical votes, these names are what will be used in meetings and communications. Are there questions?" This was one of the things he'd discussed in detail during his personal visits. No one spoke up. "Written on the placards in front of you is the name you will be known as from this day forward." The members looked at the cards with little expression, and then returned their attention to the acting administrator, who worked through a handful of other housekeeping tasks before reaching the more important matters. "The bylaws dictate that day-to-day operations of committee-sanctioned activities will be overseen by the administrator. It is the committee's responsibility to choose the person who will fill that role. Nominees may be presented now."
"Isn't that your job?" Saturday asked. As a child, she had witnessed her 12-year-old cousin married off to a man 4 times the girl's age, and had attended the same cousin's funeral a year later, when the girl had been beaten to death for burning her husband's dinner. The man had moved on and married someone else, never paying for his crime. Saturday had used her rage at this injustice to rise far above her station, amassing a communications empire that spread into 15 countries and was worth several billion dollars. And yet, even with all that power, she hadn't been able to stop atrocities like what befell her cousin. "I am the acting administrator. My job has been to shepherd the organization to this point. When this meeting adjourns, my term is over. It is the responsibility of the committee to decide who will hold the position going forward."
"Do you not want the job?"
He bowed his head slightly.
"It would be my great pleasure to serve if the committee so desires."
"Then I see no reason to make a change at this point."
Saturday looked around at the others.
"Does anyone have an objection?"
A few members shook their heads. Saturday turned back.
"Acting administrator, please take the vote."
The tally was 7-0.
"Thank you,"
the administrator said.
"I am honored by your trust in me."
Though pleased by the ease of his permanent appointment, he was not the least surprised. The real power behind the committee, a man sitting in one of the chairs around the table, would not have had it any other way.
"Next on the agenda is the field team," he said.
From a pocket of his portfolio, he removed a thin remote control. When he pushed the power button, all 8 television screens came to life. In quick succession, he relayed to the committee the particulars of the 5 primary field team targets and the 10 alternates. As he described each candidate's attributes and how he or she would function on the team, pictures of the individual appeared on the screens. When he was through, he said,
"The floor is open for debate."
Wednesday, one of the growing class of Chinese billionaires and sole surviving family member of the Cultural Revolution, leaned forward and said,
"In regards to your suggestion for team leader, would it not be best if the position were filled by someone with more operational experience?"
"An excellent question,"
the administrator said.
"Naturally, given her profession, one would think she would be more suited for solo work. That is definitely true of others who do what she does. But our candidate has considerable operational experience and possesses both the temperament and the leadership qualities we require."
He cited a dozen examples that illustrated the candidate's qualification. Tuesday, a nouveau-riche Silicon Valley tycoon, whose first wife fell victim to a suicide bomber in Tel Aviv when she was on vacation with her sister, said,
"If you're convinced, administrator, I'd say we give it a go. After all, isn't the idea that we can change pieces of the team as necessary? If she doesn't live up to our expectations, we move on."
The back and forth continued for nearly a quarter hour before a vote was taken and the full team as presented was approved.
"Our final matter today is the choice of our initial mission. If you will open your envelopes, please."
The members did so. The piece of paper they pulled out was a ballot containing 2 numbered boxes. The administrator described both potential missions, once more utilizing the video screens to help illustrate the specific problem that needed writing. Since this would be the committee's first operation, the options involved issues that were not overly time-dependent. "As a critical vote, please mark the ballot with your choice and sign your legal name at the bottom." There was no missing the apprehension in the room. Making decisions on trivial matters by verbal vote was one thing, but putting their signatures on a vote for a job that could easily go awry was something else altogether. But this had also been part of the agreement they had to accept before being allowed into the committee.
"This is how we succeed or fail,"
the administrator's true boss had told him when they had been drawing up the plans for the committee.
"Everyone involved needs to feel responsible. The field team, the committee, you."
The administrator waited until he'd collected all the votes before he tabulated the results. The decision was a close one, 4-3. Both missions were worthy, but the winner had the added benefit of being in a remote location. If things went wrong, there would be no undue attention. He set the ballots down and said,
"The Lambert matter in Alaska."
"How long until we begin?" Saturday asked.
"The candidates will have to be put into positions where they will be primed to accept our job offers first. That will take a bit of time. These efforts will also need to be coordinated so that all five are ready at the same time.
How long?
She repeated. 2 months should be enough.
The meeting was adjourned.
2.
3 hours later, elsewhere. The knock on the door echoed through the cavernous office.
Come in,
Avanti growled from behind his desk. Warren, his chief spook, entered and walked across the room, the hardwood floor creaking. He stopped in front of the desk, but did not take one of the guest seats.
Good afternoon, Mr. Avanti.
Well?
Avanti asked.
Cassidy just reported in. He's flying home now.
The meeting. I want to know about the meeting.
As expected.
So, they've officially begun?
Yes, sir.
Avanti folded his arms across his chest and grinned.
I knew it. I knew that son of a bitch couldn't resist. After all these years, he's finally got his committee.
He looked back at his spook.
And their first mission? Did Cassidy say anything about that?
Warren relayed the information their mole on the committee had given him. When he finished, Avanti said,
You're keeping an eye on these field team targets?
Of course.
And the disruption?
Ready to go. As soon as the committee has collected its team and is on the brink of activating the mission, the disruption will commence. As soon as the first phase is complete, Cassidy will anonymously feed our committee member target the information that will trigger a change.
The disruption was designed to test both the abilities of the field team and the resilience of the committee. In the worst case, Avanti and Warren would learn where the organization's flaws were, and in the best, the whole committee would come crashing down while still in its infancy.
What if they don't make the change?
Then there will be one very bitter committee member who Cassidy can manipulate even more in the future.
The first option would be preferable,
Avanti said, and then returned his attention to the file on his desk, signaling the meeting was over.
3. April 3rd, Manila, Republic of the Philippines. Ananka carried a tray through the ballroom, a ghost among the event attendees. Like the rest of the serving staff, she wore a white shirt, black bow tie, and black pants. Her shoes, also black, were killing her. Whosever idea it was for the female servers to wear heels should have been shot, something she might do herself once the job was over. The shoes wouldn't have been as much of an issue if she'd been allowed to show up right before the target arrived at the event, do her business, and split. But the client had been terrified of something going awry and had insisted the utmost care be taken. Noah Perkins, the op leader, translated this to mean Ananka needed to be serving the guests from the moment the party started in order to sell her cover. She'd already been handing out champagne to members of the Philippine elite for over an hour and a half, helping them get sufficiently lubricated before the guest of honor arrived. According to the brief, Fernando Alonso, candidate for the Philippine presidency, had 2 other stops to make before his arrival in the ballroom for his final campaign speech of the night. Alonso, the current governor of one of the northern provinces, was running on an anti-establishment platform and billing himself as the people's candidate. Given the enthusiasm of the crowd, Ananka seemed to be the only one present who found it hilarious he was in Manila courting that very same establishment. Funny or not, his attempt to gain more votes wasn't going to matter. She was there to put a stop to his campaign. A ripple of excitement rushed through the crowd.
He's on his way. He's almost here. He's coming. He's coming.
This wasn't the first rumor of Alonso's arrival that night, but this time it was true. A moment before the nervous chatter began, Ananka had heard 2 beeps through her undetectable earpiece, alerting her that the target's car had entered the hotel driveway. She eased through a gap in the mob and headed back toward the kitchen. Perkins had arranged for her to win the lottery that Mr. Reyes, the catering coordinator, had held that afternoon, to choose who would present Alonso and his wife with their drinks. The moment Ananka entered the kitchen, Reyes shouted,
Jessica, over here.
Jessica Santos was her cover name. As she weaved her way toward him, he set an ornate tray on the prep table
and placed two beautiful crystal flutes on it.
They're here,
he said, barely glancing at her as he filled each glass with champagne.
Why do you think I'm here, asshole? Is what she wanted to say, but she just smiled and nodded and picked up the tray.
Reyes put a hand on each of her arms and looked her over. She'd seen the same unhappy expression on his face when she'd won the honor of serving the Alonzos. She was giant for a Filipina, over 6 feet in her heels. Clearly, she didn't fit his image of what a woman from his country should look like. Again, she couldn't help but see the humor. She wasn't Filipino. According to the DNA test she'd taken a few years earlier, she had no Asian heritage whatsoever. What she did have, however, were excellent facial prosthetics and highly effective makeup. If Reyes or anyone else at the party had seen her without her disguise, they wouldn't have looked at her twice. Well, they might have looked twice, but they wouldn't have connected her to Jessica Santos in a million years.
You remember what to do?
He asked. Of course.
Are you to say anything to them?
No.
And if they say something to you?
I smile and act like I can't hear them above the crowd noise. He straightened her bow tie and took another look at her.
All right, just whatever you do, do not spill anything on them.
I promise, she said, then turned and walked toward the exit. In a well-practiced move, she used her back to pass through the swinging door into the ballroom, steadied the glasses with her free hand, and rubbed the bottom pad of her index finger across the flute destined for Alonzo. From a pouch designed to look like her skin, several dozen microscopic Artoff pellets dropped into the glass. As soon as they plunged into the champagne, the pellets dissolved. The false skin was off her finger before she finished her first step into the ballroom. With a subtle flick, she dropped it onto the floor and stepped on it, her specially treated sole starting a chemical reaction that dissolved the drug pouch into a small spot of harmless liquid. In the time she'd been in the kitchen, the crowd had surged toward the dais where Alonzo would soon be speaking. Sticking near the wall, Ananka worked her way around until she reached the security guards blocking access to the area behind the stage. She flashed the special card she'd been given for the occasion. After a quick pat-down, the guards let her enter, and the older one said,
"Follow me."
The crowd was nearly as thick behind the platform as out front. Ananka had to shield her cargo with her free arm as she made her way to the stairs. Twice, revelers tried to take one of the glasses, but her escort was there each time with a glare and a,
"Not for you,"
that was more than enough to scare everyone off. The guard led her onto the dais where about 2 dozen people were waiting for the man of the hour. Ananka was taken to a spot along the back edge where she could wait out of the way. A few minutes later, the rumble of the crowd grew louder, starting on the left side and spreading through the ballroom like wildfire. Alonzo had arrived. Too many people were on the stage for Ananka to visually track the man's progress, but the yells and whoops and shouts gave her a pretty good idea of where he was at any moment. Finally, he and his entourage climbed the steps and walked onto the stage. Alonzo was wearing a traditional Filipino barong, shirt made from white thin fabric with intricate designs embroidered down the front, over a white undershirt. His wife, a woman at least 15 years younger than he was, wore a golden floor-length dress and a double strand of pearls. While the president looked genuinely pleased to be there, the woman looked ready to call it a night. There was much handshaking and hugging as the candidate made his way to the podium at the center. When he finally reached it, he shouted something into the mic that made the crowd go wild. From Ananka's position, it was near impossible to hear what he'd said, but it wasn't important. The only thing that mattered was her cue. That came 7.5 minutes later, after Alonzo had made additional remarks and one of his aides waved Ananka forward. As she approached the podium, she received a raised eyebrow from her target. It wasn't a look of suspicion, only surprise. Her height again, she guessed. She handed the untainted flute to the man's wife and the other to the man himself, and then took a step back. The couple raised their glasses, and Alonzo said in Tagalog,
"Your support and belief in me will carry us to victory, and our country will be great once more."
It didn't matter where she was, Ananka thought. Politicians, regardless of ideology or language, always said the same damn things. The Alonzos lifted their glasses and drank. And there it was. Artov delivered. Ananka's job done. In approximately 24 hours, Alonzo would start feeling a slight headache. He'd likely play it off as a side effect of being so busy. The next day, his throat would be sore, and soon after, he'd start coughing. On day 3, he would be in a hospital's intensive care unit, struck down by a severe case of the flu that would prevent him from campaigning during the critical final month of the election. Ananka started toward the stairs to finish her shift. This was the part of the night she had been dreading most. Perkins had been insistent. "We can't do anything that might cause someone to wonder if the target's illness was anything but natural. You'll stay until the event is over and make everyone believe you're nothing but a server." As she reached the end of the stage, she heard someone shout behind her. Not in excitement or congratulations, but in terror. She glanced over her shoulder. Those who'd been on the dais had coalesced at the podium, most trying to peek around the person in front of them at something on the ground. Missing from the group was Alonzo. Ananka lowered her gaze so she could see through a gap that had appeared in the crowd. She spotted the candidate's face for only a moment, but it was long enough for her to see his eyes had rolled back, his skin was turning blue, and white foam was dripping from the corner of his mouth. As an assassin, there was always the potential for an "oh shit" moment. Ananka did everything she could to mitigate that possibility, but some things, like the true identity of a drug she had been given by her handler, were out of her control. Oh shit. Acting like the commotion wasn't her business, she moved down the stairs at her former pace and headed toward the checkpoint. While a few of those behind the stage were looking curiously at the backdrop that separated them from the platform, most seemed unaware anything had happened. Before she reached the guards, though, shouts rang out from the stage, informing all those in earshot that Alonzo was down. The guards at the checkpoint ran toward the stairs. The first sped past Ananka without even looking at her. The second, however, did a double take, and then seemed to connect the dots that the server who had brought the champagne might have had something to do with the chaos on stage. Skidding to a stop, the guard yelled, "Don't move!" She looked at him, her eyes wide and innocent, as she stepped toward him. "What? Why?" Another shout caused the guard to glance toward the stage. Before he could look back at her, Ananka kneed him in the groin, then leaned next to him as he doubled over, like she was checking to see if he was okay, and deftly removed the pistol from its holster. She shoved the barrel into his belly and scanned the room to see if anyone was watching her. A few moments earlier, the assault would have been witnessed by dozens of people. Now everyone's attention was on the dais. "You want to stay alive? You keep your mouth shut and stay bent over," she whispered. "Nod if you understand." His face still twisted in pain, he nodded. She guided him through the abandoned checkpoint toward the back side of the room. Plenty of people rushed past them, but none paid them any attention. In preparation for the mission, Ananka had memorized the hotel's layout. She headed for a door along the back wall near the corner. As expected, it opened onto a hallway that led to several storage rooms and, via a locked door at the far end, the loading docks. She hustled the guard into the first storage room. "Do you have handcuffs?" she asked.
"No,"
he grunted. "In that case, sorry about this." She meant it. The guy had only been doing his job. In fact, by suspecting her, had done it exceedingly well and didn't deserve the knee to his groin or the one she now sent into his stomach. As he groaned, she wrapped an arm around his neck and cut off circulation to his brain. Within seconds, he passed out. After dragging him behind a shelving unit, she returned to the door. All was quiet on the other side, so she slipped out and sprinted to the end of the hall. There, she removed both of her shoes, broke off the heel of the left one, and pulled out a key made entirely of plastic. If Perkins had given it to her, she would have suspected it wouldn't work, but she had done her own recon and obtained temporary possession of a master key from which the plastic one was created. The door opened without a problem. Several cameras were mounted over the loading dock. Perkins had told her it was live view only, no recording, but given what had just happened in the ballroom, she had to assume he was lying. Either way, they could aid in her escape. As she ran into the loading area, she made sure to face one of the cameras like she didn't know it was there. If it was recording, soon the image of a tall Filipino female murder suspect would be everywhere. Fortunately, Manila did not have a citywide CCTV system like London did, so beyond the hotel, there was no organized surveillance network. Four blocks away, she found a quiet spot down a dark alley where she removed the applications from her face that had drastically changed the way she looked. She wiped away what she could of the makeup that altered the color of her skin, but because she couldn't risk the time to do a thorough job, she knew she didn't get it all. If she steered clear of any bright lights, though, she should be okay. Off, too, came the white shirt and bow tie, leaving her in a white spaghetti strap top and black pants. She disassembled the guard's gun and dropped several of the pieces on the ground. One street over, she tossed more of the gun and the heel of her broken left shoe into the bed of a passing truck. The rest of that shoe and all of her right one were dumped next to a pile of garbage from where they would likely be stolen within the hour. The last pieces of the gun went into a drain. Now she was just an unarmed foreigner walking through the city, albeit barefoot. As a professional assassin, Ananka had developed a survival guide over the years. Rule number one, the client was not her friend. Her employers were a mix of agencies and other individuals operating in the murky world of intelligence, and they all had their own agendas. Most of the time they played fair, but even then their goals would always take precedence over those of any temporary employees. Rule number two, safeguards, safeguards, safeguards. An example of this was the recon she'd done at the hotel and the master keys she had duplicated. In addition, and also unbeknownst to op leader Perkins, she had arranged for a safe house if things went sideways. Located 3 miles from the hotel, the gardener's quarters sat at the back of a sprawling property owned by a family with old Filipino money and was secured using Ananka's new favorite tool, Airbnb. She arrived 19 minutes after handing Alonzo his champagne. She had no intention of staying for long. First thing she did was wash away the remaining makeup, restoring her skin to its natural caramel tone. She then released her hair from the bun it had been in and pulled it into a ponytail. A black plain t-shirt, a pair of jeans, sneakers, and a Tokyo Giants baseball cap completed her transition from Filipino server to African-American tourist. From a slit she'd cut into the bottom of the mattress, she extracted a messenger bag containing 3 sets of false IDs, 2 sets of hard plastic lockpicks, a stack of Filipino pesos, and $3,000. She left the equivalent of $1,000 in pesos on the dresser, with a note explaining a family emergency had taken her away in the middle of the night. Her last stop was back in the bathroom, where she removed the fan vent and retrieved a Glock 39, a matching suppressor, and a full box of .45 caliber ammo. These went into a special section of the bag. Though they wouldn't go undetected during a physical search, they would be invisible to visual checks and most scanners. She reached back into the vent and grabbed a plastic bag containing 4 disposable phones and 2 dozen SIM cards. She stuck a SIM card into one of the phones and called Shinji. He picked up before the 4th ring and said in Japanese, "Nakamura Restaurant. Sorry, we're about to close, so it's me," she said in English.
"Oh, hey, didn't expect to hear from you for another day or two."
Shinji's English was flawless, which made sense given that he'd been born and raised in the San Gabriel Valley east of Los Angeles and had yet to set foot in his ancestral home of Japan.
"I need a way out," she told him.
"Can do."
A click and the line went silent. 30 seconds, another click.
"The earliest flight leaves in 90 minutes. Can you get to the airport in time?"
"No planes."
"Oh, well, you should have told me that."
"No passport checks." A pause.
"Is there something I should know about?"
"Correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't you supposed to be monitoring the news?"
"Of course I am, but if you've seen one Filipino soap opera, you've seen them." "Oh, wait."
Over the line, the sound of a television increased, and Ananka could now hear a correspondent reporting that presidential candidate Alonzo had collapsed.
"That wasn't supposed to happen, was it?"
Shinji said.
"No."
"So probably not good?"
Your deduction skills never cease to amaze me.
How about a ship?
Given that I'm on an island, that seems the logical choice.
Shinji found a Panamanian registered ship called Loretta Star that was due to leave Manila an hour before sunrise. An agreed-to sum was transferred into a Cayman Island account, and arrangements were made for a skiff to ferry the girlfriend of the captain to the ship after it was underway. Until then, Ananka had a few hours to kill.
4.
Ananka caught a cab 2 blocks from the safe house and gave the driver the address of the building where she'd last met with Perkins. The driver had his radio on so loud she couldn't help but hear the latest news about Alonzo's condition. Most of it was no more than rumors. The reporter even said several people in the ballroom claimed to have heard gunshots right before Alonzo collapsed. The reporter had already turned the story into a possible assassination attempt. Though he was overdramatizing it, as his lot was wont to do, he was actually right, which annoyed her because it would only legitimize sensationalism in the future. Ananka did learn one piece of news. Alonzo had been taken from the ballroom to a nearby hospital. No updates on his condition, though. Of course, she didn't need them. If he wasn't dead already, he would be soon enough. That son of a bitch Perkins had done a masterful job of setting her up.
Since we're only putting him out of action temporarily, I'm thinking a nice case of Artoff flu would work great. How's that sound to you?
That's how he'd presented her with his plan for dealing with Alonzo.
That sounded good to her. Many kinds of synthetic flu had been developed for just such purposes.
Artoff's appeal was that it would gestate in a target system for 24 hours before laying him up for weeks and likely leaving him frail for a long time after that. Though her job was usually to kill, there were a few times when she'd been hired to deliver a less permanent type of hit. As she cursed Perkins under her breath again, a report came over the radio saying police were looking for a tall Filipina last seen at the hotel.
If the cabbie only knew who he has riding in his back seat.
At least Perkins hadn't leaked details of what she really looked like.
Yet.
The taxi turned onto the street where Perkins had been staying. When they were still half a block away from his building, Ananka said, "This is fine." As soon as the cabbie pulled over, she paid and hopped out. A few scattered businesses were still open, restaurants mostly, the rest having locked their metal shutters for the night. Unusually, no one seemed to be eating at any of the outside tables, though at a few of the restaurants, several customers stood in the doorways looking inside. When Ananka walked by one of these places, she discovered why. Everyone's attention was on a television broadcasting a chaotic scene outside what appeared to be a hospital. Even the restaurant staff had stopped to watch. She wondered how long it would be before word got out that Alonzo was dead.
Dear God, let me be on the ship by then, she thought as she moved down the street.
Perkins had been using a set of rooms above a dress shop. She approached the building from the other side of the street and stopped before she got too close. At least one light was still on in his flat. She pulled out the disposable phone. The crappy device came with a crappy camera that had a crappy zoom, but it was better than nothing. She pointed it at the second-story window and zoomed in. Though the curtains were closed, she hoped to see movement, but either Perkins was staying away from the lamp or he was already gone. From her previous visits, she knew he'd rigged the main building door so that a buzzer sounded in his room every time it was opened. He'd also put a camera on the street somewhere. She'd seen the live feed playing on a dedicated monitor next to his computer. Unfortunately, she'd never taken the time to figure out where the camera was. All she knew was that she couldn't go much farther without entering the frame. She backtracked to a gap between buildings that led to the next street over. The narrow passage stank so strongly of garbage and God knew what else, she was forced to pinch her nose to keep from retching. And it wasn't until she reached the uneven sidewalk of the other street that she could really breathe again. There were no restaurants on this street, only run-down apartment buildings and a few empty lots. Perkins wasn't a stupid man, not completely anyway, so Ananka knew he'd likely extended his surveillance to the building behind his. She allowed herself a minute to search for where he might have placed a camera, but spotted none. To play it safe, She broke into the building next to the one behind Perkins's place and took the stairs to the roof, then crept onto the place directly behind his. At the back, she looked down on the roof to Perkins's building. Quiet and empty, just how she liked it. His building was a floor shorter than the one she was on, so she lowered herself over the side and dropped the remaining few feet. The stairwell door was locked, but the mechanism was cheap, and she picked it in no time. She moved inside and sneaked down the stairs, searching ahead for cameras. As far as she could tell, she reached the landing of Perkins's floor undetected. She eased the door open and peered into the hallway. Camera mounted on the wall opposite Perkins's door. She didn't recall it being there before. She might be able to disable it by tossing something at it. But A, she didn't have anything to toss, and B, the resulting noise would alert Perkins if he was inside. Screw it, she'd have to hope he wasn't watching. Lockpick in hand, she rushed out of the stairwell and inserted the pick and tension wrench into the lock on Perkins's door. 7 seconds later, she shoved the door open and rolled into the room, coming to her feet, ready to fight, halfway to the desk Perkins had set up as his control center. The computer and monitors were gone. She looked toward the mattress Perkins had slept on. His bag was also missing. "Damn it," she muttered. She knew finding him there had been a long shot at best, but God, how she had hoped she would. Having no time to waste on disappointment, she sloughed it off and searched the room, hoping he'd left something behind that would tell her where he went. But there wasn't even a scrap of trash in the bin. Probably headed to the airport the minute I reported for work at the hotel. In all likelihood, he'd been safely in the air when Alonzo sipped his deadly champagne. Sirens. Distant and not unusual for a place like Manila, but given her current circumstances, she gave them a bit more attention than she would have normally, and realized they were moving closer. She hurried back to the doorway and examined it. "Oh, come on," she whined as soon as she spotted the disc near the bottom of the jamb. She checked the door. Sure enough, there was a matching one on it. Both had been dirtied up to not appear obvious, but now that she'd seen them, she knew them for what they were. Contact points. When she'd opened the door and moved them out of alignment, she'd likely triggered an automated phone call to the police. She looked back into the room. She was willing to bet that somewhere in the flat, maybe hidden under a floorboard or in the walls, was evidence of the plot to assassinate Alonzo. If the police found her, they'd find that, too. Perkins covering all his bases like a champ. "I'm gonna find you, you son of a bitch, and when I do..." She wiped down the few surfaces she had touched and headed back up the stairs. On the roof, she moved to the front of the building and looked down just as the first police vehicle arrived. A moment later, two more joined it. That was more than enough for her. Using a discarded box and the imperfections of the wall, she climbed back the way she'd come, ran over to the stairwell entrance, and had just reached the door when... boom! She flew several feet before smacking down on the roof. Dazed, she blinked a few times before glancing over her shoulder. A roiling column of smoke and fire was rising from the space where Perkins's building had been. There was only one logical explanation. Perkins had wired the place to blow up, most likely assuming she would be caught in the explosion. Her former op leader had reached a whole new level of asshole. 5. The voyage from Manila to Singapore took 2.5 long, quiet, maddening days. When the harbor finally came into view, Ananka gladly paid the captain extra to have the skiff take her ashore instead of waiting until they docked. Though she still had the 4 disposable phones and handful of SIM cards, the SIMs were all for Philippine networks and wouldn't work in Singapore. So the first thing she did upon reaching land was find a cab driver who would take U.S. dollars and had him drive her to a convenience store where she could buy several local SIMs. At a nearby park, she checked her voicemail. There was only one message. "This is Marcus Denton. You will return my call immediately." Short and sweet, and delivered with barely contained fury.
Denton was the client contact in the Alonzo job, a job for which he'd stressed numerous times that no one was to die, especially not Alonzo. He undoubtedly wanted an explanation. Or she supposed he could be calling to inform her that if she ever set foot in the States again, she would immediately be arrested and hauled off someplace like Gitmo to spend every day of the rest of her life as a guinea pig for experimental torture techniques. The message had been left only a few hours after she'd been taken to Loretta Star, so it was 2 days old already. Had that 48 hours of not responding destroyed her chance to convince him she wasn't to blame for the assassination? Likely. Still, she'd have to try. Her first call, though, was to Shinji.
Huh?
He answered, more asleep than awake.
I mean, Nakamura rest. Just tell me everything's all right. Ananka? Are you in Singapore already?
She heard something falling to the floor, and then an annoyed mumble. A moment later, Shinji said,
Oh, wow, I guess you are, huh? Totally thought I'd set my alarm. What was the question?
Tell me that everything's okay.
Could you, define okay?
Shinji!
Sorry. Yeah, so, I wouldn't exactly say everything's, well, okay, Mr. Denton called.
Yeah, I heard his message.
I mean, he called me.
You?
I know, right? How did he get my number?
The getting of Shinji's number wouldn't be that hard for someone with high-level NSA clearance like Denton. The real question was how her client knew Shinji worked for Ananka in the first place. The partnership was not one she advertised.
What did he want? To talk to you. I explained to him that you were incommunicado and that—
Please tell me you didn't use that word.
Why not? It's accurate.
She closed her eyes and rubbed her forehead.
So you told him I was out of touch and? And that I'd make sure you give him a call as soon as you surfaced.
What did he say to that?
Something different every time.
What do you mean every time? How many times has he called?
7. No, wait. 8 times.
Ananka sighed. He didn't ask about the job?
Once or twice, but I said I only handled getting you in and out and didn't know anything about what happened in between.
Anyone besides Denton call? While Shinji's number was not known to any of her clients, except for Denton, apparently, Shinji did monitor the automated line that job requests came in on.
No new jobs, but, we've had some cancellations.
How many?
5.
Did you say 5?
I did.
How many do we have lined up?
Before cancellations, 7. So now 2.
Thanks, I can do the math. A pause.
You're not going to like this.
As opposed to all the things I've liked so far?
You're really not going to like this.
Just tell me. He took a deep breath and blurted out,
All 5 want full refunds.
Up until that point, Ananka had been pacing a path at a quiet end of the park, but Shinji's words stopped her in her tracks. To book Ananka required a deposit of 1/2 her fee. If the job went away, the money stayed. That was industry standard.
Did you remind them what non-refundable means? They claim it doesn't apply in this situation.
In what situation?
Right, so I did a little checking around, and apparently, well, you've been excommunicated.
Ananka had not been rendered speechless for years, but that counter had just reset to 0. Shinji said,
Are you still there?
Yes, she managed.
What do you want me to do?
She blinked. About what?
The money. Should I refund them?
Not yet. I'll get back to you. She hung up. Denton. He must have been the one behind the blackballing. Perkins wouldn't have had that kind of pull. She needed to talk to her client. She needed to talk to him right now. It was a little after 3:30 p.m. in Singapore, which meant it was 12 hours earlier in New York, where Denton worked. But he did say return his call immediately.
Yes.
The crisp, no-nonsense male voice that answered did not belong to Denton.
I'm returning a call.
Name?
Ananka.
A pause that could have meant nothing, but she knew better.
Hold, the man said.
The wait lasted 90 seconds before Denton came on.
I assumed you weren't going to call at all.
As my colleague told you, I was indisposed.
That's unfortunate.
The words were stated matter-of-factly, the angry tone of his voicemail nowhere to be found.
Not sure I agree. It was better than ending up in a Philippine jail.
Well, you did commit murder.
I definitely disagree with you on that.
So you're saying that you were not the one who delivered the drug that killed Alonzo?
What I'm saying is that the drug I was told I was delivering was Artoff. I performed my job exactly as presented.
And yet a man is dead.
Ultimately not by my hand.
Denton said nothing for several seconds.
I take it you're accusing Mr. Perkins.
It's not an accusation. Perkins supplied the drug. He had to know what it was. If he won't tell you the truth, put him in a room and I'll get it out of him.
If only that were possible.
What do you mean?
I'm not playing this game with you. Please do not-
Wait, she said, sensing he was about to hang up. I had no knowledge of Perkins's plan whatsoever. I'm being set up. You have to see that. If necessary, I'll find him and make him tell you the truth.
Here's what I suggest you do. Go someplace quiet. Don't do anything to draw attention to yourself. And maybe, just maybe, you'll live through the week. Goodbye, Ananka. Don't call this number again.
Hold on! What are you- But the line was dead.
She almost hit redial, but what more could she say that she hadn't already? She needed to give Denton more than assurances. She needed to give him Perkins, tied up and talking, and to do so, she needed help. She called Shinji back. Given Ananka's temporary, she hoped, banishment from the intelligence world, she thought it best to keep as low a profile as possible while she hunted for Perkins. To this end, she took a cheap room in a hotel far from the city center, using a brand-spanking-new, never-before-seen ID. Once ensconced in her new hideaway, she dropped her things on the bed and turned on the TV to BBC International. Not surprisingly, news of Alonzo's collapse and death dominated the broadcast.
Fan-freaking-tastic, Ananka thought as she popped another aspirin.
A photo from his final campaign event appeared on the screen. In it, Alonzo and his wife had just taken glasses of champagne from a server who was turning away. The picture zoomed in until the server's face, Ananka's altered face, was in profile. The screen was then split between a close-up of this photo and a clearer one of her looking toward the loading dock camera.
Philippine authorities are looking for a woman named Jessica Santos, the reporter said. She worked that night as a server and was the one who presented Mr. Alonzo with the champagne he drank seconds before he collapsed.
The only bright spot Ananka learned from the broadcast was that Perkins still hadn't fed the authorities information about who she really was. The next story was about Alonzo's funeral, scheduled for the following day. Crowds were expected to fill the streets in his hometown, around the church where services were to be held, and for those who couldn't attend, it was to be shown live on all the major networks. She muted the volume and jumped into the shower. Unfortunately, all the hot water in the world wasn't going to wash away the layers of anger and guilt that clung to her. Unwittingly or not, she had allowed herself to be used as Perkins's puppet, and that was a stain she would have a hard time removing. Hearing her phone ringing forced her to finally get out. After a quick wipe down, she grabbed the cell off the counter and checked the caller ID. Shinji.
Tell me you found him, she said.
Kinda.
Kinda?
You're not gonna like it.
I wish you'd stop saying that.
Sorry. What should I say?
You should just tell me what you found.
Perkins is dead.
For a second, it was as if all the noises of the world had stopped.
What?
Perkins is dead.
I heard you the first time.
Then why did you say what?
How did it happen?
There was an explosion in Manila the same night as the mission. According to the police report, it took out a whole building. They found his body in the rubble.
The skin on Ananka's arms began to tingle. Where was this explosion?
You want the exact address?
If it doesn't inconvenience you.
The sound of a keyboard clacking.
Here we go. Paz Street. Crap, no number listed. According to the news report, the body was found in a dress shop on the ground floor. The place is just south of...
I know where it is.
You do?
Was Perkins mentioned by name in the news report?
Nah, just body found. His ID came from one of my contacts.
How good is this contact?
Never had a problem before.
Even ignoring the evidence, she'd seen that Perkins had already fled the building. The explosion had been large enough to rip apart anyone inside, meaning identification would have needed to be made by DNA, a process that took time. The results would then need to be cross-referenced to find a match, in this case with someone not even from the same country. It had been less than 72 hours since the blast. Even a week wouldn't have been enough time.
Forget about the body. It's not him.
It isn't?
He's still out there. Find him.
6. Ananka arrived in Shanghai, skeptical of the tip from the anonymous source Shinji had dug up. The informant claimed Perkins's employer had secured a 34th floor apartment in a building along the Huangpu River. Though the employer's identity was not given, the implication was that it was a large Chinese firm that did a lot of business in the Philippines and was not pleased with the possibility of Alonzo becoming the next leader. While the explanation felt far too detailed and ready-made, Ananka had no other tangible leads, so had little choice but to check it out. She would do so very carefully, however. Under the cover of darkness, she flew a WhisperTech miniature drone with mounted camera, arranged by Shinji, around skyscrapers along the river toward the target building. Within the first 2 minutes after the device arrived at its destination, Ananka picked out half a dozen suspicious men loitering outside the building, and three others she positively identified as hunters she had worked with in the past. She flew the drone up to the 34th floor and spied inside the supposed safe house. Two men lounged on a couch in front of the TV, neither one Perkins. On the coffee table in front of them was a pair of pistols. A check through the other windows of the apartment revealed no one else. The safe house was not so safe. After that disappointment, Shinji found a promising lead in Seoul, so off Ananka went. Though Perkins was not there either, she found evidence he had been less than a day earlier. Using Korea as the starting point, Shinji traced Perkins's trail, sending Ananka to New Delhi, then Abu Dhabi, then Cyprus, and finally to Rome. In the Italian capital, the clues took Ananka to the unused storefront on the east end of the city. A check inside revealed it was empty, but someone had been present very recently, probably even spent the night. Ananka discreetly showed a picture of Perkins to people working at the shops along the street. She received only shaking heads until she entered a small market half a block away. Like elsewhere, the clerk was already in the process of saying no before Ananka had even finished setting the picture down, but once the woman actually saw the image, her head stopped moving.
"See," she said, her lip curling in disdain, "I have seen him before."
It turned out Perkins had purchased some cigarettes, but it was the way he looked at her teenage daughter that had made the impression on the woman.
"When was this?" Ananka asked, her Italian flawless.
2 hours ago, maybe a little more.
The moment Ananka exited the shop, she contacted Shinji.
Motorway footage, street cams, whatever you can get your hands on, she said. Look back no more than 3 hours. You'll find him somewhere.
She was right. Exactly 43 minutes before she'd arrived at the store, Perkins appeared on a security camera feed 4 blocks away. He was on foot and in the company of 3 men, bodyguard types and armed, if the bulges under their jackets were any indication. Shinji bounced from camera to camera, tracing Perkins's route. Ananka hurried back to the motorcycle she'd obtained upon arriving in Rome, and then, with Shinji's voice in her ear guiding her, followed Perkins through the city, past the Vatican, and toward the airport.
"He must be leaving the country," she said as she sped southwest. "Check flights. Whatever he's booked on, get me a ticket."
By the time she reached Fiumicino Airport, Shinji had determined Perkins was scheduled to fly out on a Delta Airlines nonstop flight to Atlanta, Georgia. He was using the name Carl Pinter and had a ticket for business class, row 3, seat A. Shinji had purchased Ananka a seat in the same section, only at the back, on the other side, row 9, seat J. She reached the gate just as boarding began. From the cover of the economy class crowd, she watched the business class passengers file past the gate agents into the tunnel to the plane. The sixth person to have his boarding pass scanned was the very not dead Noah Perkins. Ananka grinned. She waited until the bulk of the passengers were boarding before she checked in, and then used the economy entrance onto the aircraft instead of the one for business class. When she reached her seat, she peeked over the center aisle toward the front of the plane. She had a moment of panic when she saw his seat was empty, but then she spotted him emerging from the front galley area where he must have been using the toilet. She ducked until enough time had passed for him to settle in before she checked again, and found him exactly where he was supposed to be, belted into seat 3A. Just in case he planned a last-minute exit, she continued checking on him until the doors were shut and the aircraft was taxiing toward the runway. At that point, she allowed herself to relax. She had him now. Lunch was served not long after they were in the air. Ananka watched Ex Machina while she ate. It was the kind of film she loved. Men who thought they were smart, and women who were smarter. Okay, technically an android, but a female android. Before the movie ended, the cabin lights were dimmed so passengers could get some sleep. She paused the film and glanced at Perkins. He had turned his chair into a flat bed and was lying back wearing an eye mask. As she watched the rest of the film, she extracted a small kit from the bag she had obtained with Shinji's help in Abu Dhabi. It looked like a simple bathroom pouch. Inside was a comb, a small cake of soap, a half dozen cotton swabs, and two small pill containers, one labeled ibuprofen and one sleep. The comb broke down into several pre-designed pieces, which, when combined with parts from two of the specially made swabs, created a ring that, if worn correctly, looked unremarkable. But if the wearer were to turn her hand palm up, four thin needles would be visible sticking out of the band. She set the device down and poured a cap full of bottled water into her unused coffee cup. She dumped in two of the pills from the sleep bottle and three from ibuprofen. The water boiled for a moment as it chemically reacted to the combined ingredients. Once the bubbling stopped, the drug was ready. Next, she pulled on a pair of puncture-resistant skin-colored gloves and dipped the ring's needles into the solution. She then slipped the ring over her finger. All that was left to do now was touch the metal tips to Perkins's exposed skin, and he would remain asleep for the duration of the flight. And several hours afterward. If Shinji had done his job, a medical team would be waiting in Atlanta for the inevitable request for medical assistance. She peeked across the cabin to make sure Perkins hadn't woken, and then eased into the aisle and headed toward the front galley. As she neared the front, she heard someone behind her lumber out of their seat. A glance over her shoulder revealed the passenger was a tired-looking middle-aged woman clutching the toiletry bag all business-class passengers received. No one for Ananka to concern herself with. When she entered the galley, a flight attendant sitting near the door started to stand. Ananka smiled and said, "Just stretching my legs. Don't need anything." The flight attendant resettled into her seat. The curtain was drawn across the entrance to Perkins's aisle. Ananka pulled it to the side and stepped through. The first thing she noted was that all the passengers along the aisle appeared to be either asleep or watching their TV screens, just how she wanted it. The second thing she noticed was the prick of a needle against her arm. Before she could turn to see the source, the world disappeared. 7. Dublin, Ireland. Dylan Brody sat on his favorite bar stool, convinced he was in a fix. No one had told him there was a problem. In fact, just the opposite. The meat was on, the goods would be ready to move, and the deal would be done. So said Harmon, the logistics guy, who just called with the update. But Harmon was the problem. In Dylan's experience, even the most mundane packages he was hired to transport came with a layer of paranoia affecting everyone involved. A little nervousness would have been expected, but Harmon sounded as cool as Tom Hiddleston ordering room service. Hence Dylan's suspicion. He thought about calling Harmon's boss, Mr. Line, and expressing his concern, but then